Good morning, Wisconsin. Guess who's on vacation again? Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at the Avenue in downtown Milwaukee. It's time for Point Taken. Ready to take the reins by herself. Here's Kristen Bry.
Jeff, that's fire. What a funny way to start the show. Indeed, Steve is on his way to Sicily, a well-earned vacation.
I hope he's listening.
Sicilian's listening too.
I'd be careful.
That is very funny. I don't know if we're going to play that every day while Steve is gone, but maybe we should. I don't know.
Put me down for a yes.
I'd be on the yes side,
just
too.
Just everyone perked up, was not expecting that opening segment. Yeah. All right. So, of course, those are the voices of our friends on Friday, Bill McCoshin, Joe Zepecki, and we have a lot to talk about this today. I don't even know how we're going
to
fit everything
in. I'd like to think we're friends every day.
Every day.
Yeah.
I would say friends of the show specifically on Fridays, because that's when you're here. But you're always friends of the show.
I listened Monday and I commented. I sent you texts during the show.
Did you send you?
I corrected you and Dan Bice.
Dan Bice and I, I didn't have Dan's number.
What
so
did Dan
all
get
of
wrong?
A sudden I knew.
Well, she used my name and said, well, McCoshin says Tony Evers got 42% in 2018. Dan's response, whatever.
Because Dan had said it was in the 30s. And so Bill was listening and was a real-time fact checker. All right. So senators once again are trying today to end the federal government shutdown. They're set to vote on some funding bills. There has been no movement or breakthrough in negotiations. And meanwhile, it seems like President Trump is now embracing Project 2025. So there is a lot to talk about. So I wanted to start with this way before we get into our takes immediately. I want to give you each a chance. If you had to explain the shutdown to a layperson, how, Bill, I'll start with you. How would you explain what the shutdown is and why it's happening?
I would do it this way. The continuing resolution would only extend the government at its current funding levels. There are no increases nor any decreases in this continuing resolution for 7 weeks. In order to, you can pass it with, 50 plus one votes in the Congress, but in the Senate, you still need a 60-vote majority to get it across the line. Chuck Schumer did bring Democrats to the table on the last continuing resolution in March. On this one, there's been three Democrats so far, which I'll mention in the Say Something Nice, that have gone along with it, so it's been bipartisan, but they don't have 60. And Republicans only have 54 senators, so they cannot do this by themselves. Here's how I would explain it, and I know it's not exactly the way the White House is doing it. Democrats are asking for $1.5 trillion in additional spending to extend the government for 7 weeks. We are $34 trillion in debt. I would start with that talking point and say, hell no, we're not going to spend one more dime to keep the government going for 7 weeks. Instead, the White House and Republicans are talking about, well, this actually is, they want health care for illegals, and that's partially true. It's they want to undo something that was in the Big Beautiful Bill that eliminated emergency care for illegals. And even guys like Ro Khanna have admitted that's actually in the bill. But I think the bigger sell is actually on spending. Why would Republicans agree to $1.5 trillion in additional spending just to continue the government for 7 weeks? Makes no sense to me.
All right, Joe, how would you explain it to a layperson?
Republicans have total control of Washington. Because of the way our government is set up, Democrats in the minority have the tiniest sliver of power and leverage. What they are saying is, if you want votes for anything, we want to stop healthcare costs from skyrocketing next year. That's the one thing we want. We'll get you the votes. And Republicans are saying, no way, we would rather shut the government down than continue a policy that has protected Americans' pocketbooks when it comes to how much they pay for health
care. So I don't think Republicans have – I'm going to agree to all that. I'll stipulate to that. I don't think Republicans have done a very good job of explaining that piece of it either. These subsidies, these enhanced subsidies, were passed as part of the Inflation Reduction Act. They were passed by every Democrat –
actually, the American Rescue Plan then extended by the Inflation Reduction Act.
Every Democrat who has voted no so far on the CR voted for these to expire at the end of 2025. So that is a fact. And that's one of the bad budgeting things about D.C. is everything expires at a period of time, so they have to have some other cliffhanger. But those were set to expire at the end of this year. Not now, not on November 1st, not on November 15th, not on December 1st. So there's time to work that out. And I actually think the Republicans would be willing to work with Democrats on that, but they're not going to be at the same levels that were post-COVID, where there were enhanced subsidies. I mean, the Affordable Care Act was anything but affordable. Healthcare costs have more than doubled in the last decade under multiple administrations. So, I mean, the biggest lie of that year was you could keep your doctor if you wanted to. Turned out to not be true. This is also not an Affordable Care Act, but I think there will be some negotiations after we get through this this period of time on the CR to continue that in some form or fashion.
Well, and that's my question for you, Joe. How much of the Democrats' stance right now is about healthcare, and how much of this is about standing up to Republicans and having pressure from progressive organizations saying that we, using that, what you said, the slightest sliver of power and leverage to stand up to this administration?
¿Por qué no los dos? It can be two things at the same time.
Okay.
Right? I mean, like, so what's happening is at the end of the year, you have to re-up your plan for the next year if you're on Obamacare. There's more than 20 million Americans who can't get employer-sponsored coverage, who aren't on Medicaid. They have to go shop for their own plan. What has started happening this week is that certain states, insurers who are in those marketplaces, have started sending letters to the people on the plan saying, hey, it's time to re-up. Here's what you paid last year. Here's what you're going to pay next year. And the numbers are staggering. So this is from Virginia, where a 60-year-old couple who makes $85,000 a year, last year their silver plan was $595.94 per month. Without these subsidies continuing, their 2026 plan is $1,890.84 per month. These costs, you could say you don't like Obamacare, and I know Republicans don't, but this is a policy that is stopping consumers from getting hit squarely in the pocketbook on just one part of their expenses every month, which is healthcare. So this is both, in my view, good politics and good policy for Democrats.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back,
much more on the shutdown.
Much more about the shutdown, and especially the fact that now Trump is embracing Project 2025. And who is Russell Vaught? All right, stay with us. This is Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. We're talking to Republican strategist Bill McCashin and Democratic strategist Joe Zepecki on this Friday. All right, let's move on. So I just asked Joe if this is more about standing up to Trump or protecting health care costs and extending these subsidies. Joe, you say it's both. Bill, I will now ask you, is this a strategy on the GOP's part to try to concentrate power into the executive branch as Russell Vaught? Not Vaught.
Probably an unintended consequence. But I will start with, I think that's a very good question. And I actually think it's both. I don't know that Democrats have the leverage they think they do at this moment in time. And I think at the end of the day, whether it's today or Monday or Tuesday, I think enough Democrats will push this thing over the line with some agreement that we will have a negotiating period over, you know, extending some kind of healthcare subsidies. But the consequence is the president and OMB do now have the power to shut things down and to eliminate funding. And, I'd caution that they need to be smart about that and judicious. And, Stephen, I've had some arguments and some agreement about, you know, DOGE and all those things. These are things you got to be very careful about. For example, FAA folks are furloughed now, but they have to work, meaning they're not getting paid. So could there be a sick out at some point in the next couple of weeks? Yeah, that's a risk for sure. So you want to make sure that you avoid that. So if they're going to do cutting, I wouldn't just do it in blue areas. I think they cut or slow
they're
down.
Freezing some projects.
Froze projects in Chicago today worth $2.5 billion or something like that. You don't want to make it.
Do you think it's
political.
A bluff?
No. I think they will do it.
Okay.
Well, and let me add a little bit of context here. So there have been times when the way the calendar and the days of the week fall, that like 12 or 13 days into a pay period, the government shuts down. And then on day one or two, federal employees don't get paid. The way the calendar worked out this time, they all got paid very recently.
on the 30th, maybe.
Right. Yeah. So, like, so they're 4 days into, and usually they don't get paid until the 15th.
Yeah.
And so that does create some space for an agreement. We'll see if one happens. I think there's a path to it. Like, I think you're right that it's like, what's going to ultimately happen here is Republicans in the Senate are going to say, this is the timeline or the framework. We can't include it in this 7-week CR, but we will, you know, have the vote on it before we do the full budget for next year. That's a logical, plausible way to get out of this. The challenge is, and Bill knows this, you've been at this even longer than I, trust is everything when it comes to governing. And I think the fair challenge that Democrats have right now is Republican members of the Congress haven't really batted an eye when the executive branch has said, we know you passed that. We know you called for that spending, but we don't like it, so we're not going to spend it. And so Democrats are saying, well, if you're going to abdicate our constitutional prerogative to define what the government spends, how can we trust that you're going to sit down and say, okay, we're going to, you know, work together and figure out how to continue these subsidies. Maybe it's a 1-year extension instead of a 3. Maybe it's a little bit less than it was last time, but there's still something. And if you're a Democrat, I think the question you got to ask is, like, how can we trust that Republicans are going to do this in good faith? And then, like, just go, oh, well, I guess there's nothing we can do when Trump turns around and says, I see that bill you passed. I see the law. I don't feel like I have to follow it. And that kind of underscores just what a crazy place we're in at the moment.
Yeah, and I would point them to Wisconsin, of all places, because there was a lack of trust between GOP leaders in the legislature and Governor Evers for many years. And there still is on many levels, but they were able to come together on a budget deal. There are a lot of people on my side who don't like that budget deal because it had a 15 or 16% spending increase.
My side, too.
Overall, and there are people on your side who don't like that it didn't spend enough in schools, education or whatever. So, but they figured it out, right? They came in a room and figured it out and set aside. But Joe's main point is right. Ultimately, this comes down to trust, but it also comes down to skill and ability of the leaders. There isn't a Nancy Pelosi in the room for the Democrats. Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries are not on that level. They're not on the Harry Reid level. I mean, there have been some really, really strong Democratic leaders over the years, and there have been some really strong Republican leaders over the years. Those two guys aren't in that category, and I think that's hurting the process.
Joe, do you agree with that?
I would be fine with a sea change in the leadership of my party. And I think
you're
made
in the majority.
That clear.
I think there's a lot of people who agree with you. Do you have ideas of who you think could do a better job?
Of people who are just seated? Off the dome, Chris Murphy from Connecticut or Brian Schatz from Hawaii. I think we need folks who are younger than Schumer on the Senate side. Jeffries, I don't take as much issue with as Schumer because I don't think he's been at it long enough and he's only been in the minority. And, you know, Nancy Pelosi wasn't Nancy Pelosi overnight.
Those are big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a fan of hers overall, but as a leader, I am a fan of her. She knew how to wield power.
Okay. Let's take another break quickly because then I want to just, like, you laid out a way that this ends, but who wins in the end as far as messaging is concerned. So I want to get your guys' ideas on that.
If we've got time, I also have a little story of my own from shutdowns past.
Well, we can get to that after the break. He's Joe Zepecki. He is Bill McCashin. I am Kristen Bry, and this is Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bry. We are talking to Joe Zepecki and Bill McCashin. All right, I was going to ask, because I was listening to something the other day that was basically saying shutdowns never really lead to legislative wins, but they can lead to messaging wins.
Yeah.
And I don't know what has to happen for Democrats to win on messaging this time around, Joe?
Well, we're winning right now if you believe the polls, and we don't need to get into our whole poll discourse, right? This is also the third shutdown that we've had while Donald Trump is president, because there were two in his first term.
The longest one ever, also.
And I think what's happening is the Trump team knows those first two shutdowns hurt them politically. They hurt his standing, and they probably think that's part of why he lost in 2020. And so this time, they're taking a new tack that I just think is completely inappropriate, right? They're trying to weaponize the shutdown not like, listen, Caroline Leavitt and President Trump and Vice President Vance want to go out and make their case to the American people, do that. But for federal employees to be sending internal emails to hundreds of thousands of federal officials saying, this is the Democrat shutdown, it's their fault that the government isn't open, is like, it's just not appropriate. There's no place for that.
But is it legal? Because that's what Steve and I were talking about this week, as far as if it's a violation of the Hatch Act, as far as how partisan it is.
It's probably not legal. Like, if I had done that when I served in the Obama administration, I would have been fired the next day. Full stop. Like, that's how seriously they took the ethics piece of that in the Hatch Act.
Yeah, I think it's a situation where both sides are not winning right now. Despite what they might say, I mean, polling also shows Democrats. NPR polling at the beginning of this week showed Democrat favorability at 26%, the lowest in their history. So I don't know that either side is winning right now. At the end of the day, the people I talk to want government to work. Do they favor one side or another? Yeah, but that swings from election to election, more so than it ever has in our history. So, but more than anything, they want the government to work. And they're like, why can't you guys sit down and figure this out? And that's what happened in Madison. It happened quietly. It happened behind closed doors. And nobody really knew until they announced the deal was done. And they went to the floor and passed it. So is there quiet conversation going on right now? That would be what I would be encouraging. It does not appear that that's the case.
Well, that's because Tony Evers is very different than Donald Trump, as far as I think. Tony Evers on this show said bipartisanship is cool in his very grandpa nerdy way. But I'm not sure Donald Trump is about to say that same thing.
And that's the point that I want to make, is that the tea leaves I'm reading is that the quiet conversations are happening on the Hill. They're not happening with the President of the United States, who thinks it is appropriate to troll Schumer and Jeffries. Whatever you think of them, they have a leadership role in a co-equal branch of government, and he calls them into the White House after canceling one meeting, and now they're gonna do it. And he sticks a Trump 2028 hat in front of them, and then he makes some dumb AI video putting a sombrero and a mustache on Hakeem Jeffries. That is not serious. That is not how you build trust and actually get to an agreement. And the clips of Donald Trump that are all over the internet this week of from before his life in politics, saying, if you can't keep the government open, it's the president's fault. It's up to the president. Well, then come on, man. Be serious.
All right. On that note, Bill, you can rebuttal after the bottom of the hour news. We will still be here. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve is on day one of his two-week vacation. So we will manage to get by without him.
Is today a travel day, or is he there today?
I think he's traveling today.
Hope he's listening.
He's listening. Hi, too. Steve. Maybe he's not. Steve. Maybe he's actually checking out. He deserves it. All right. That is the voice of Bill McCaution and Joe Zepecki. We spent the first half hour talking about the shutdown. So let's move on to the other. I guess there's a lot of big news this week and some that went under the radar. But the big one was the unprecedented 800 generals flying in to Quantico and having a speech from Pete Hegseth and President Trump. And a lot of, let's start, because Bill, I texted you this week, and I think in the back and forth, you might have missed it, or you just purposely didn't answer it.
Since the first time you slapped my hands, I have none reflexes, N-U-N, from St. Francis, so I open everything you said.
Okay, so I asked you, so in the quote from President Trump's speech, he said, "We're under invasion from within, no different than a foreign enemy, but more difficult in many ways because they don't wear uniforms." And then he said, where was the domestic enemy? So I asked you specifically, who is he talking about when he says the enemies that are within?
I think he's talking about people that shoot Charlie Kirk or shoot Melissa, what's her last name? The speaker
Hortman
from Minnesota. There are a lot of really troubled people in this country. Sadly, they're on both sides of the political aisle, it appears. And I think that's what he was talking about. The speech itself, the whole thing at Quantico, didn't turn out to be what they sort of sold it as. I mean, it was weird that they brought
it was like a weird scolding.
All the top brass to Quantico for something. And And, you know, a lot of people on the internet thought, well, this has some, we're going to war or something like that. It was actually a, I would call it an end of wokeness seminar from the president and Pete Hegseth. I'm okay with merit in the military. I think that's how it was founded. I think that's what's made it the best in the world. You know, I don't know that you have to continue to do performative things like that. I mean, you can just do your job, right? These are the rules. This is, everybody's got to follow these rules. I don't know that you have to keep pumping your chest on these things. So that one I didn't pay as much attention to because it really didn't
But even if that's
me.
Who he's talking about, these lone wolf disturbed people, in what way does it make sense that that's a military problem? And then because it's also the same speech where he's basically talked about training in American cities, having military training in American cities, despite the fact that the military cannot be domestic law enforcement.
Well, they can protect military U.S. facilities, right? And that's what's likely to happen in Portland. They need to be invited in to do anything other than that. I'm okay with using military in major cities to lower crime if that does in fact lower crime, and it has so far in Washington, D.C. They now have sent the military to Memphis. The governor was on the air this morning. I saw him, and he was pretty excited about it, so obviously he welcomed them. The governor of Oregon has said, no, thanks. We don't want it in Portland, but I think it's going to happen anyway. So that's one where there could be partnership. To Joe's point or at the end of the last segment, at the end of the day, the president's job is to lead, or the governor's job, right? If the budget's out of whack or we've got a stalemate, it is the executive's job to bring people around the table and figure it out. In this particular case, as it relates to the shutdown, I don't think there's going to be a change to the clean CR. I'd be surprised if there was. But it will. To Joe's point, there's going to be a need for a commitment that we are going to work on these things, and it'll be done by Thanksgiving, right? Whether that's enough to get to 60 in the Senate, we'll see. I hope it is. But at the end of the day, this will come back to him if it's not solved sooner than later.
There are things this administration does that are scary, and there are things that this administration has done that are just dumb. And bringing 800 flag officers at the cost of millions of dollars from around the world to sit in a room and listen to whatever the heck that was from Hegseth was dumb. It just is. Like, this is the ultimate, this whole meeting could have been an email, but usually that's you and four of your coworkers piling into a conference room and then walking 8 feet back to your cubicle. This was so unnecessary. It is all for show. And that's the hard part, is trying to disentangle what this administration is doing for show that is just stupid, like that was, and what is an actual threat that we should take serious and be worried about, like undermining due process for people who should have their rights protected under the Constitution, undermining the rule of law, or saying, we don't care that a judge ruled against us when we sent Marines to California. We're going to do it in Oregon anyways. Oh, the governor doesn't want it? We don't care. We're going to figure out a way to do it. Because to this crowd, it increasingly looks like the ends justify the means. And that is not, in my view, consistent with American principles laid out in the Constitution and for almost 250 years, upheld. You don't use the military for domestic law enforcement, period. And frankly, why the hell do they need to? The one big bill just like 4X'd the size of ICE. Hire those folks. Train those folks. Deploy them. I disagree with that bill. I never would have voted for it, but it was done through regular order.
Yeah, it was.
And now they have the resources. So that policy, there's nothing I can do about it. So go do that. Don't, at more cost, because it's actually more expensive to deploy the military to these places. It's going to be less effective because these folks aren't trained for that, right? So what, are we going to do some training of the military for a role that we don't need them to really do while we're also training more ICE agents? Like, this is just madness. And I think people who served recognize the absurdity of a lot of what Hegseth and frankly, to a lesser extent, like I thought Hegseth was a total disaster in that thing. But to sit there and call these men and women who have served this country for decades, right? Because if you have risen to that rank, you have been in for a long time. To sit there and say, you're fat and we don't want fatties anymore and you're all going to, like, no beards. I'm like, what are we talking about? It was nonsense. And so there is some of this that is serious, which is the part I just talked about. And there's some of it that's just stupid theater. And I think it's important that we try to understand which is which.
All right. Well, we will leave that there. But I want to talk about something that we discussed offline, but I don't think has gotten that much attention, which is the National Security Directive identifying anti-Christian and anti-American views as indicators of radical left voices that was signed this week. So we will talk more about that after this on Point Taken. Well, welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bry. We're here with Joe Zepecki and Bill McCoshin. And we'll put a pin in my thing for a second.
That's national security, too.
That's
also national
security.
I think there's international stuff.
So there's been... This is just always... There's so much to keep up on. So are we now in a new war on drugs where we are legally just bombing boats in the middle of the Caribbean? Is that where we're at now?
So I watched the general... Jack Keane this morning explained this, and the difference, or what he believes allows the U.S. government to do what they've been doing, is they have designated these organizations terrorist organizations and armed enemies of the United States.
So does that fall under the original authorization for use of military force, which was the AUMF passed after 9/11, which has never expired?
He was a little ambiguous about whether that was the case, but he gave a justification for how we could do this. I mean, I think it's fair to say we are trying a very different approach to the war on drugs. And, you know, we're not going to try and interdict at the border anymore. We're going to stop them when they're in the water.
But you can also interdict on the high seas. And that has been the process for years, where if a boat does not stop and you suspect it has drugs or human traffickers on it, a sniper from a helicopter shoots out the engine, the Coast Guard boards, and they conduct a search. That has been the way this is done. So for those who haven't been following the news, and there is so much news.
There's a lot of news.
Every day.
There have been multiple occurrent instances in the last several weeks where U.S. military assets have missiled boats out of the water, killing whoever was aboard.
Three
times.
Yeah.
Right? And so this is an escalation. It is a change, however you want to call it. There's also a legal side of this, because this happened in international waters. And my take on this is that the Pentagon and some probably lawyers within the Trump administration, after the first couple of these attacks, went, whoa, 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 whoa. We have to figure out the legal side of this. We can't just be killing people without any justification. And so subsequent to those attacks starting, you get this memo from the White House sent to the Congress saying we have declared that these cartels now fall under these terrorist designations. That's after the fact, folks. Like, is that CYA? It's not very good CYA. And like the idea that the Pentagon would send their top lawyer to the Hill this week, as reported by the Wall Street Journal, and both Republicans and Democratic senators were pressing the general counsel for the Pentagon, say, what is the legal justification for these attacks? And that lawyer saying, we cannot give that to you in writing, is not appropriate, right? Like the legislative branch gets to do oversight. The Gang of Eight and the intelligence communities, this is all structured for a reason, so that no individual branch or no president of either party gets to just do whatever the hell they want and kill anyone they want internationally. So this has not yet exploded into a big story, but it is a really important story about the rule of law and the command and control structure of our armed forces and the use of force. Like, I'm old enough to remember when Barack Obama ordering the droning of a American citizen abroad, right?
It was more than one.
Who was a member of a terrorist organization, spawned a huge outcry and investigations and hearings and document production. So this is a space to watch, because I don't think that the Trump administration has their story straight yet on why this is happening, how this is happening, and how it is comporting with the laws of the United States.
You're going to try a different strategy. You, to Joe's point, you do have to have the I's dotted and the T's crossed, because whether this is investigated by an oversight committee today or tomorrow or next week or next year, it will be investigated,
yeah.
Right? The notion that this will, they'll never have to explain what their justification was, is false on its face. There will be a different administration. The Democrats will have control of one or both houses at some point in time, maybe sooner than later, at least as it relates to the Congress, and there will be hearings on this. So my hope is they have their justification down. I'm okay with trying a different strategy. I think their point is, if they do something so dramatic, it will just end this. I'm not sure. We don't have any experience on that, whether that will end up being the case. But it's shocking off for sure.
All right, we got to take another break. Stay with us. I'm Point Taken. All right. We really scratched the surface of all the things we could have talked about. But quickly, Bill, Joe, we're going to move on when we come back from the top of the hour news to Wisconsin politics. But if you have a closing statement on the state of our federal agencies this week, federal government this week, what is it, Bill?
Both sides need to come together and get the government back open.
All right.
That's what the people voted for. They didn't vote for shutdowns. No side's going to win ultimately in this, and this takes leadership.
At some point, you got to stop digging, right? Like when it comes to that trust thing, at some point, they have to start finding their way out of this. And I certainly hope for big reasons and for personal reasons that they get the government open. Because I want to go to D.C. with my family in 12 days or whatever.
Oh, I didn't know you had a vacation plan.
Oh, yes. We've been a family. Like, I think most listeners know, I lived in D.C. for 6 years. I have like a D.C. family of friends and loved ones. And in the 8 years we've been a family, we've never gone to D.C.
Oh, really?
And it's finally on the books. And this happened.
You want it to be open.
Figure it out.
You want it to be open.
You sound like Steve, who is all worried about his flight being delayed because of this. All right. Stay with us. Bill and Joe will still be here after the top of the hour news. We will talk about developments in the Wisconsin governor's race.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
Welcome back to the 11 o'clock hour. Steve is on day one of vacation, but we are here with Bill Nakash and Joe Zepecki for at least another half. Joe's going to stick around for the whole hour.
Yeah.
Bill's got to get back to Madison, so he's
leaving
at the bottom of the this hour. But let's move on to Wisconsin's governor's race. There was a new candidate who announced this week on the Democratic side. Since you guys were here last week,
anyone who got out,
Bill Berrien has gotten
that was
out.
Also this week,
Bill Berrien dropped out, but like basically within a couple hours after you
right
guys
after
were here
we left. Yeah.
Last Friday, and then Missy got in Tuesday,
Monday.
Yeah.
She was here Tuesday. So let's start with updates on the Democratic side, Joe.
Missy Hughes' launch video is, I think, the second best of them after Sarah Rodriguez's.
Oh, really? Do you put Fran third then?
Yes.
Okay.
Missy has a story to tell about working with Wisconsin businesses, trying to strengthen Wisconsin main streets. That is not usually what Bill and his friends on the right try to caricature the Democratic Party as pro-business. And so it's a really interesting way to differentiate herself, is to say, I'm the business leader in this race. And
that's a good point to a lot of things she's gotten done.
Yeah, no, exactly. Oh, yeah. Like, ran $1 billion, you know, dairy organization, has, like, Bill knows, you were Secretary of Commerce. There are worse ways to get known around the state of Wisconsin than walking around with, you know, grant money for businesses and to redevelop Main Street. So she's got a story to tell and a case to make. Now, she also had a pretty good start, announcing $200,000 raised in the first 24 hours for campaign.
Yep.
That's pretty good. Kel DeRoy's, for example, has raised about that in the first couple of weeks, is what they announced. But we also got news from who I believe is the front runner at the moment, Sarah Rodriguez, this week, which is that she has already raised $2.5 million and announced a commitment from an outside group, the Democratic Lieutenant Governors Association, to spend at least $2 million on her behalf during the primary. Now, none of that says much about where these folks' politics or policies are, but the reality of our politics today is that that is the game. You have to build the resources to go tell your story. And so far, Sarah Rodriguez is way out in front of folks who have stories to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's a question of how much can they raise to go tell it to people.
Well, I guess that's the question. So how much? So let's fast forward to January when mm-hmm. this last quarter's fundraising will be announced. How much do you think the voters follow who has the most money?
They don't.
This still has to come down to how they're differentiating themselves.
Yeah, but it tells you whether or not they'll have the ability
to get their message out.
To go and get their message out. And yeah. so the stakes have been raised that, you know, if you're candidates other than Sarah Rodriguez, well, you better clear that $1 million mark by the end of the year here, or she's going to look like a far and away favorite.
So the interesting part about Missy, having had that job, I was Commerce Secretary for 4 years, and I used it to build a statewide network. I was going to run with Tommy Thompson in 1998 for Lieutenant Governor. A lot of people probably...
He made a better decision in the end.
A lot of people have probably forgotten that, but it is a very good position to get yourself around the state and to meet with business people and quote unquote non-political people. So she has a network. It isn't necessarily a base. That network may prove to be good for her fundraising. And I think $200,000 in the first 24 hours is a good number for anybody. But is there a lane for an outsider, sort of more moderate in the Democratic primary? I don't see any recent evidence of that. And not to say that, you know, lightning couldn't strike and Missy ends up finding a way to squeeze through that primary, but it is the smallest lane, in my opinion, on the Democratic side. So
let me just remind you that Joe Biden was not the leftmost candidate in 2020. Tony Evers was not the leftmost candidate in 2018. Right.
Fair enough.
Like, you know, there's some recent history of, again, and I think this goes to like the job of Fox News and right wing talk radio is to like paint Democrats as the most extreme version of themselves. But then when the voting starts, frequently in recent history, you know, maybe not in the New York City mayor's race, I'm not suggesting that, right? But like, there's a lot of examples where it turns out the Democratic Party is closer to the center than the caricature is.
So on our side, since last Friday, Bill Berrien dropped out, mm-hmm. which we sort of predicted on this show. And then by the time we got to WISN to tape up front, Matt confirmed that that was what was going to happen that day. And it wasn't a surprise. I never thought Bill had a base, and he's a good guy. I've met him multiple times, and anybody who's willing to put their hat in the ring is worthy of respect, in my opinion. The campaign was not well run,
mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of unforced errors along the way. So when the last thing happened that finally pushed him over the edge to get out, it wasn't a big surprise. So that leaves Tom Tiffany, congressman, who got in about 10 days ago, and Josh Shulman. And one of the things that got cut out of me and Joe's participation on Upfront last week is Tiffany is going to be the front runner from day one. He will have all of the congressional delegation endorsing him. It appears that a lot of the big money people are getting behind him, and he has the biggest base. A congressional seat is about 750,000 people in the state of Wisconsin. He's won the 7th congressional 4 times, so he would have the biggest base. Having said that, Josh Shulman has 2 advantages. Number one, he's 24 years younger than Tom Tiffany. That's an asset, not a deficit. And he has geography on his side. Josh Shulman lives within 75 miles of 75% of all the voters in a Republican primary. He can get to Kenosha in an hour and a half. Tom Tiffany will take him 5 hours to get there.
Well,
from
and also he's
spending
a lot of time in D.C., I would imagine.
He's going to have to take votes
doing
in D.C.
what? They're not governing
right?
out
That's
there.
True.
So I wouldn't rule Shulman out. Even though he will move to the 2 spot, he has been to all 72 counties and he has worked his tail off. It will really come down on our side. Can either of them raise money? Neither have proven to be big fundraisers. Josh hasn't had to as Washington County executive. Tom hasn't really had any formidable opponents mm-hmm. in the 7th CD, so we'll see if the money comes in by the end of the year. And Tiffany claims to have, you know, more than $2 million in commitments, and we'll see if that's true.
Okay, well, now I have to ask you, though, because on this station earlier this week, your old boss said to John McCure that he is still looking at it, and he's seriously looking at it, regarding running for governor. And of course, I am talking about 83-year-old Tommy Thompson.
I'm going to say a few things. One, okay. I love Tommy Thompson.
I know you
Two,
do.
He's been a father figure to me, and I wouldn't be where I am without the opportunities he gave me. Three, I don't believe he's going to be a candidate for anything. But for the listeners who are either too young or too ignorant, there are some on our side who I will call ignorant, who don't understand this. Of the top five gubernatorial races in history in Wisconsin, John Blaine in 1922 was number one. He got 76%. Tommy Thompson got 67%. He's number two. Walter Kohler Jr. got 64% in 1952. He's number three. Tommy Thompson got 59% in 1998. And Tommy Thompson got 58% in 1990. So he has three of the top five finishes of all time in the state of Wisconsin. So for those of you throwing shade on him on social media, knock it off. The Republican Party wouldn't be where they are today without Tommy Thompson.
I don't think it's that. I think it's like when he answers a question like that, is that him being a showman and like playing along?
I think
or do you
he's
think
showing...
he seriously thinks that he's like, I still got it.
I hope to he's be alive at 83. This guy's got unbelievable energy, and it's never waned. And I think the day he takes a day off is probably the day he dies. So I love that part of him, and he's always optimistic, but no, I don't believe he's going to be a candidate.
All right, when we come back, say something nice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You keep saying your side is better. It's time to say something nice about the other side of the political aisle on Point Taken.
Come on, people now. Smile on your blood.
All right. Here we go. Who wants to go first? Who's got a juicy say something nice? Bill McCosh, go ahead.
So mine's not juicy.
Three Senate Democrats, Fetterman from Pennsylvania, Cortez Masto from Nevada, and King, who's an independent but caucuses with Democrats, who voted for the continuing resolution on Tuesday. Likely to vote for it again today. They're going against their caucus. I think they're doing the right thing. I'm hoping there are more of them today to get to 60. If not, there's probably one or two more chances on Monday and Tuesday. And if not, then this is probably going to go to Halloween or even Thanksgiving. So I'm calling out those three senators. They went against their caucus. I think they did the right thing for the good of the country, and I hope there are more today.
All right.
Staying with the United States Senate, Rand Paul of Kentucky calling out his Republican colleagues for saying when the government demands a stake in corporations like NVIDIA and U.S. Steel, that should offend conservative and Republican sensibilities as much as it offends their sensibilities.
It does.
When they go,
it does.
Oh, Zohran Mamdani wants the government to own five grocery stores. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so I think the common theme here is like we like it when politicians are willing to call their own side out on their BS and go against the grain. So Rand Paul, good on you, sir.
All right. And mine comes from, there might be more than this, but I was reading that Pennsylvania's Representative Brian Fitzpatrick and Bob Brasnahan have both joined with some other Democratic representatives saying they will forego their pay so long as the government is shut down, which I think shows a lot of integrity. Because that is one thing that I think a lot of us are like, so all these other people don't get paid?
Should be automatic.
Should be automatic. None of these people should be getting paid until they get this solved. So the fact that they stepped up and said that, hats off to them.
Yep.
All right. When we come back, grab bag.
All right. Since we got most of the politics out of our systems, let's finish up with some grab bags.
All right, indeed. Bill McCashin has to get out of here. Joe Zepecki's going to stick around for the rest of the show. So, Bill, since you're going to be first. Yes, he'll be listening on your own.
He's going to listen for a couple minutes and be like, this is boring in terms
probably.
Of but it's going to be a fascinating conversation.
I think so, too.
I got some kudos for mine last week about the Brewers. This is a historic season. And so I will stick with the Brewers this week. I had a funny story from D.C., but I'll use that next week. The Milwaukee Brewers will play the Chicago Cubs in the I-94 series starting tomorrow at AmFam Field at 108, and they play in Milwaukee on Monday, in Chicago on Wednesday and Thursday, and then back Saturday if necessary for Game 5. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Not only did the Brewers win the best record in Major League Baseball, I happened to be there on Sunday in the crowd when they won their 97th game, which was a franchise record. The place was packed. It went crazy. I mean, I don't know how this is going to end. I hope it ends with a World Series, but even if it doesn't, this has been a very fun summer, and they have given a lot of Wisconsin some great joy over the course of this summer. So all my best to, and I'm not a Craig Counsell hater. I am a Cubs hater. I think Pat Murphy's better, and I think our team's better, and this is going to be our year. So let's go Brewers.
All right, Joe.
Lovers of art, anyone who is interested in like the world and like cinema and film, One Battle After Another, the new movie from Paul Thomas Anderson, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Benicio del Toro, and Sean Penn, is incredibly good.
I haven't heard you talk about a movie like this in a very long time.
Yeah, like, there are movies that are marketed where you kind of see the whole movie in the trailer. And you couldn't go like, oh, I know what this is about, and I know what's going to happen at the end. This is not that movie. You think you are walking into an action adventure caper movie, and you will end up seeing something that is much more provocative and will make you think about your place in the world and our broader society and identity and power dynamics. And it is really, really good. So I am encouraging everyone who likes film and cinema, go see One Battle After Another.
And it's in the theater. It's not streaming right now.
It is in the theater right now.
Okay. All right. Mine is giving love to my husband and his event this weekend, Milwaukee Oktoberfest, kicking off at the Summerfest grounds today. I think it's free beer and free entry.
In Milwaukee?
Well, just for an hour. Okay. Just for an hour. I think from 4 to 5. I have to look that up. But yeah, I think there's an hour of free beer today. It starts at tomorrow and Sunday at 11. I will be emceeing the Wiener Dog Contest and the Miss October Fest.
What time is that?
So I think Miss October's tomorrow at 8, and the Wiener Dog is 12:30 on Sunday.
Who's the competition? Because you got ripped off in the cream puff thing.
Well, I'm not competing. I'm emceeing. So I will be interviewing the contestants.
Well, Melissa might be your PA if you need one.
Yeah.
For the Wiener Dog.
For the Wiener Dog. Is she a big Wiener Dog fan?
She wants a Wiener Dog to be our next dog.
My funny story, but when I was a kid, I really desperately wanted a Wiener Dog. We already had one dog, but I really wanted a Wiener Dog. And my kid logic at like 5 was my mom was like, "You're not going to take care of this dog. Like, we're not getting another dog because I'm not taking care of another one. And I don't trust you to actually take care of one."
She was right.
My kid logic said, "Well, they got really short legs, so I don't have to walk it very far."
True.
And so check out Milwaukee Oktoberfest. The weather is going to be incredible. I'm pretty sure they are going to get the rights to be able to show the Brewers game tomorrow at the fairground. So if you don't have tickets to the game, it'd be a very European way
to watch
the game and be able to watch it in community, outside, drinking beer, having brats. So I'm very excited. I'll be living down at the Summerfest grounds this weekend.
Have fun.
I will.
Have fun.
Yeah.
I'll be listening, guys, in the last half hour.
But we still got a minute left before we go to the news. Any other closing thoughts before we hand it off to
news?
So
I was in the EEOB this week, the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, which is connected to the White House.
Okay.
I've only been there one other time in my life. It was like The Shining. Because of the shutdown, there were no people in there.
Oh, weird.
It was freaky weird. But I'll tell you quickly, when I was there in 1992, I called my mother in Superior, Wisconsin on a hard line and told her, you know, I'm the 7th of 8 kids. Mom, I'm at the White House. To which my mother instantly replied, "That's nice. Your sister was just on the Today Show." So even in 1992, being at the White House wasn't big enough to be number one in the McCashin household that day.
Did you get to bowl when you were in the EEOB?
I haven't seen the bowl.
Little known
yet.
Fact:
no.
The White House bowling alley is in the basement of the EEOB.
Oh, it's not in the White House.
Correct.
Yeah.
Oh, that did not know that fact. All right. Why was your sister on the Today Show?
Ride the Rockies. She was part of the Denver Post at that time, and she was on with Willard Scott.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Bill McCashin, thank you so much, as always, for being here. We will see you next Friday. Joe is sticking around to have a conversation around, a big conversation around Democrats and their strategy. But welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bride. Joe Zepecki is sticking around with me for the last three segments. We're going to have some fun. So, this is going to be more podcasty than radio-y, I think.
I love it.
So, one of the, I don't even know if it's solely online discourse, because it's also playing out in the New York Times and the Atlantic, but trying to get people up to speed if they have not followed this. So, Ezra Klein, prolific opinion writer for the New York Times now. He started Vox. He's been writing
Author
about politics
of why
for
we're polarized.
Yes, he's been talking about politics in a
big
very
thinker on the left.
Yes, for decades. Ta-Nehisi Coates, also an unbelievably brilliant writer. Between the World and Me is, I think he won a bunch of awards for that book. Black writer, and they are friends, but
they're beefing. They'd be beefing,
but in the right way, correct? Like, and so. In the wake of Charlie Kirk's murder, Ezra Klein wrote a pretty controversial. He had a lot of pushback on an op-ed where he said the famous words from the op-ed were that Charlie Kirk did politics the right way, and Klein is kind of on this brigade of how do we make a bigger tent?
Yep.
How do we make sure? How do we get Democrats back to a place where it's not unfathomable that a Democrat can win in Arkansas or Missouri, and does it take that kind of evangelizing that Charlie Kirk was doing to be talking to people that we disagree with, and also running candidates who, Democratic candidates who are pro-life or who maybe are not as in line with the purity politics of some progressives. And on the flip side of that, Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a follow-up piece or a reaction to that in The Atlantic, and basically stands on his 10 toes, saying that, like, if you dehumanize people, that is a lot. That is, you draw the line there, and we cannot have them in our tent. And they ended up having a fascinating conversation together as friends, as peers, kind of tussling this out. Now, you can say that this is a binary, but I think it's beyond their conversation. That's kind of setting the stage. But it is a bigger conversation of, how do Democrats get out of this hole? As far as Bill said earlier in the show today, they're at 26% positive rating right now. There is not, at least I'm missing, any kind of real leadership of, like, this is where we're going. This is how we get back to red states and actually appeal to the populace there. And so I just thought this was I'm taking advantage of the time that I have with just Joe as two lefties or left center left people to have this conversation of, like, where do we go from here? And is this the right conversation to be having?
It's not the only conversation to be having. It's an important conversation to have. I'm going to choose to start, like, in the dialogue between the two of them. One of the things they talk about is when Bernie Sanders, in his campaign for president, went and did the Joe Rogan show, and people on the left got big mad because Joe Rogan is transphobic, and therefore we shouldn't platform him and we shouldn't go on his shows. And where I come down on that is that's ridiculous. Bernie Sanders and many other Democrats need to go on shows on platforms like Joe Rogan. And there's a difference between Joe Rogan's worldview and how he has talked about trans issues. And there's a difference between Charlie Kirk and how he talked about the trans community. And so I the left has not gotten this right. We need to talk to more people in more places. And the dehumanizing piece of it is one that I struggle with, right? Anyone who's listened to this show has heard me ferociously defend the rights of trans people. This is personal for me. It is important. Like, these are basic human rights that everyone is entitled to. And to scapegoat a community every time something happens is deeply distressing to me. And I think at the same time, the trans community does not have the same profile or platform in our culture and in our society where we can assume that everyone understands what there is to understand about the trans community. And so, like, for example, gay marriage in this country was legalized in 2015, sorry. And for years and years and years before that, it took a long time. It was an incredible fight for that to happen.
In 2008, I was living in California when Prop 8.
And there were things like, yeah, Will and Grace on TV, where gay characters were in the culture. And a little after that, Transparent was in the culture. That was an Amazon Prime show. And the order of magnitude of difference in terms of how many millions of Americans watched Will and Grace and had those characters in their life, you know, on their TV screens, compared to a much less watched, you know, much less culturally relevant show about a family that had trans members in it, is in the soup, right? People are generally afraid of that which they don't know. And when one side decides this is who we're going to demonize and villainize, people's guard goes up. And the way through that is through that. It's not by saying, well, if you don't understand trans people, if you don't know anyone who's trans, and if you have some questions or some concerns, we're going to immediately declare you are our enemy. I don't think that is how we change the way that the trans community is accepted in society in the way that has happened for the gay and lesbian communities. And so that's, I don't know, that's a lot there.
There's a lot there, but it's also, I mean, that's like one issue, yeah. Right? Then the bigger issue. So let's take a break and come back as far as, because I think part of it is also, is it the wrong strategy? Or is it, as far as like a political strategy? Or is there just a pendulum swinging? And this is where we are in the pendulum right now with where the culture's at. So let's come back, talk more about this with Joseph Ecke. I am Kristen Bry, and this is Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry here with Joseph Ecke, talking bigger strategy for Democrats going forward and the, I don't want to say stalemate, but there is a part of the party that is on the progressive side that there should be no compromise. The idea of purity politics on a variety of issues versus needing to win back majorities. Like if we want to, if the Democrats are going to take over the Senate, they have to win in Ohio. They have to, what is the other, Arkansas,
Missouri. This yeah. To me was the most jarring part of Klein's column, which was that for many Americans, it is easier for them to see the end of America than it is to see or envision a Democrat winning a Senate seat in one of those races.
Yeah.
And I think he's probably right, but that's insanity. Like, it's just stupid. Barack Obama won the state of Indiana in 2008, right? And like, is 17 years a long time? Sure. But when you're starting to be our age, doesn't feel all that long ago.
I mean, 2008 does not feel that long.
Yeah, like the way to win for Democrats, and I said this week online in relation, you know, responding to a former state legislator by the name of Fred Clark.
Oh, yeah, who's Democrat, now running for...
Who's running in the 7th Congressional District. That's the Tom Tiffany seat right now. It's like, it's an enormous, giant district. It's like the largest district in America that isn't an entire state. And it's been consistently like 60% plus Republican voting for years.
Well, who was the last Democrat to hold that seat?
Dave Obey.
I don't even remember that name.
Oh, wow. Ooh. Okay, we'll teach you about Dave Obey.
Okay.
But the point I made is like, this is the way, is to organize like crazy, run everywhere, communicate clearly what you are for as an individual, not as a party, right? Like the candidates get to have a say here. And I think the role of the Democratic Party or the movement on the left is not to say you can run Lobsterman in Maine. You can run, you know, logger, business leader Fred Clark in northern Wisconsin. But, oh, you can't run, you know, in this district person who we don't think is in line on enough issues. No, 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 no. We got to stop doing that.
So what do you mean? Who's we?
Democrats.
Like the party.
The left. Well, here's the thing. I think it is.
Because the party has a say in who runs, who they want to back, right? Yes, like, obviously, anyone can run. But as far as the back door, like the conversations happening offline is often like who the party's going to back.
The blob. Is what it's sometimes called, right? Which is like the conflagration of the party, the funders, the orgs, right? Like mm-hmm. the different groups that are nonprofits and they're focused usually on an issue, interest groups. You know, not all special interests are like walking in with a $1 trillion check and buying elections. Some interest groups or special interests are people who care a lot about like reproductive freedom or, you know, protecting, you know, fighting climate change. And so that blob of those groups, what I'm saying is I believe Democrats do need a bigger tent. We have to be a big enough tent for people as far left as Zohran Mamdani and as far right as Liz Cheney. That is my position. Kristen is rolling her eyes or making
a
face.
No, I'm not rolling my eyes. My eyes are going back because I'm trying to think of, like, is that realistic? Like, in this last election, obviously, that was the attempt. But there was a lot of people who were not very happy about that. So do you lose people along the way if you move, you try to make the tent so big that even center-right people can find a place?
It's hard. It doesn't mean that's not what we have to do, right? Like, yes, it is difficult. And there's this notion.
So you are more on the side of Ezra Klein then?
Yes.
As far as like building the bigger tent and having more understanding for where people are and meeting them where they're at and still finding a place for them.
Yes. And but I'm also old enough that I can name the last Democratic senator from Arkansas, Blanche Lincoln, right? And like really admire and respect Claire McCaskill, who represented Missouri in the United States, right? So like, let's maybe go to break with this.
Okay.
Everything changes. In 2008, after Barack Obama swept the presidency, front page of the Wisconsin State Journal had a red and blue map of the state of Wisconsin, and it was almost entirely blue. And the headline was, "Is Wisconsin Forever Blue?" So that was in November of 2008. And by November of 2010, the Scott Walker era had started. Republicans had won majorities in the legislature that they still have to this day. Like, things change. Things happen. And so we have to stop catastrophizing that, like, we're stuck and we're never going to have power unless we dramatically change. And, oh, we're going to go all the way to, like, just hard left. And if you aren't with us, then you have no place in our movement. No. We need to build the biggest possible tent so we can build the most possible power. And I believe you can do that without giving an inch on core human rights. And you know, without like sacrificing your principles in the name of building power.
All right. With that, we'll take our last break of the show. He's Joe Zepecki. I'm Kristen Bry on Point Taken. Well, a big thanks to Bill McCosh and Joe Zepecki for being here with me on Friday. They will be here next week. Thank you, Joe. I hope you have a fun weekend this weekend.
I will.
Yeah.
You have
a lot planned.
Wedding. Gonna go see Lech Walesa, former Polish president, is in Milwaukee
Amazing.
On Sunday. Yeah.
All right. Well, I thought we would end on a high note because we've not mentioned that, well, the station has, this show hasn't, that Dr. Jane Goodall did die this week. And I caught this snippet from a deeply reflective conversation she had about her legacy. And it's actually part of a documentary that is called Watch, or Famous Last Words, Dr. Jane Goodall. So I thought we would end this week's set of shows with wisdom from the woman herself.
This is a moment right now, as people are watching this, where maybe the biggest story in the world is that you've passed away. I think it'll be a global story. I think there'll be global mourning. And I think a lot of people will be talking about who you were. So who would you say you were?
I would say I was somebody sent to this world to try to give people hope in dark times. Because without hope, we fall into apathy and do nothing. And in the dark times that we are living in now, if people don't have hope, we're doomed. And how can we bring little children into this dark world we've created and let them be surrounded by people who've given up? Mm. So even if this is the end of humanity as we know it, let's fight to the very end. Let's let the children know, you know, that there is hope if they get together. And even if it becomes impossible for anybody, it's better to go on fighting to the end than just to give up and say, okay,